Okie dokie. So let's talk a little bit about the Arthurian tradition and the, because it, again, it's not straightforward, but it has these two major elements really, which is the Arthurian tradition of the establishment of Camelot, and then the Grail Quest, which are two. So these are two different elements really that you find that are both part of the same traditions. One of the interesting things about the whole Arthurian tradition is the way in which it is a fusion again of esoteric Christian ideas and therefore Middle Eastern ideas and Welsh, Celtic, Brythonic ideas. And by the time we get to Malory and the sort of the Arthur that we know, there's a quite complex and intricate story being told based on both these traditions. And you go back into the Mabinogion, to the earliest Welsh stories. There are stories that relate to Arthur as a king. But what we don't find is what we don't articulately find. In the Welsh stories is an integrated myth. You find these separate kind of stories and poems that talk about this figure who is about the establishment of balance, of sovereignty, and who pursues the chaotic forces and brings them into balance. I mean, there's a very powerful story of the Mabinogi called The Tale of Culhwch and Olwen, in which Arthur and his court pursue this great boar, the Tuilctoic, who's disturbing the land and eventually subdues the boar. Arthur and his court. There's this great boar hunt that goes through the land. But Arthur, in the very earliest times we come across him in Welsh tradition, is this sort of demigod, magical kind of figure. I just read you a wee bit from the poet David Jones, really, which will give us some idea of that kind of territory.
David's, where the
four
is supposed to come ashore.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. No, it's.
I always think in my mind that the seven four is something to do with them, because the ball goes into the sea after the through the land. Yeah. So I always thought the seven four was caused by the seven four. Mm-hmm. And I know some people have mapped the journey across the land, haven't they?
Yeah.
One of the great images you get about Arthur, and is this figure that's embedded in the land, who's this figure of sovereignty, who is this god figure. And we get this poem by David Jones, who talks about the sleeping lord, who is a presence of potential sovereignty that sleeps within the land, that needs to be awoken in order to establish balance. And so so we have David Jones talking about this thing. And is his bed wide? Is his bed deep on the folded strata? Because he's imagining him inside the land. Is his bed long? Where is his bed? And where has he lain him? From north of Llanfaimwllt, a name of double gladius piercings, or south to the carboniferous vaultings of Goyer, where in the sea slope chamber they shovelled aside the shards and brecker, the domestic litter and man squalor of gnawed marrow bones and hearth ash, with shovels furnished of clavicle bones of warm-felled great fauna, denoted the life signs, the crocked viatic meal, the flint-worked ivory, the sacral seashell trinkets, posited with care the vivific amulets of gleam-white rodded ivory, and with oxide of iron, ochred life-red the cerements of the strong limbs of the young noblest, the first of the sleepers of Britannia. Now he's referring there to this idea that the skeletons were found in Goa that were daubed with red ochre. And again, we're back with this resurrection motif, that actually that the idea of the red and the white coming together is an image of the sleeper in the land who will live again. And this image you have of Arthur, of the king who died but will come again, the king whose grave can never be found. So there's this image of this sort of potential sovereignty inside the land that is tapped into and will come again, will resurrect itself.
The red and the white of the
place
in
the
alabaster.
No, yeah. Exactly. That's partly what it is, because where I put it down as a day, it is sort of. So in the very earliest ideas, we have this figure, this kind of god figure, an Arth. The word Arth in Welsh means bear. So he is the bear protector of the land. And you get this very old Welsh stories about, you find there's another story called Math, son of Mathonwy, which means bear, the son who is like a bear, who is a king, who represents this spine of sovereignty around which everything turns. Now you see that image, and it's interesting, given that Malory is so important, because Malory was from the House of Warwick, and we have this image of the bear who holds the ragged staff. Mm-hmm. So this bear who defends the Tree of Life, who defends the center point. Now, when you look at Arthur in his activity, even in the Malory's writings of Arthur, he is mostly the stable center point. In the beginning, he's the king at war who establishes the kingdom. But once he's established the kingdom, his role then is to be the king in the middle of the kingdom, alongside Guinevere. And then it's the knights that go out and do things. His main function is to stay centered and to be the place that everybody comes from and returns to. Now, that happens until the Grail Quest happens, and the Grail Quest is the beginning of the end of the Arthurian epic, right? Because the Grail Quest goes beyond the world. So that whole Arthurian story is about establishing balance, establishing peace, establishing civilization in wild and disturbed places. And that having been accomplished, then there is that deeper quest that appears, that then takes us from the world of Arthur, the world of keeping everything stable, into the transcendental experience of seeking the Grail. And so what you then come from, they leave the court of Arthur, and they encounter, if you like, that principle of sovereignty on a higher arc. So the Fisher King, who is linked also to the maimed king, the pierced king, is this figure who represents the quality of the Grail that is beyond the world and takes us into the transcendental. In terms of the Tree of Life, it would be so Arthur would sit in Tiferet, but the Fisher King and the maimed king sit in the gateway into the supernals. So it's the same story, but at a higher arc this time. So that having established balance, established peace, established it's then that kind of deeper journey into a deeper degree of surrender and a deeper sense of resurrection. Now the coming of an Arthur is this interesting kind of figure, really, because he is this the bear who defends the tree, defends the principles of civilization, the principles of the civis. But in a certain sense, he also becomes the he in his end of his story becomes the maimed king, because there's this great battle between him and his son. And we have this very powerful thing where this image of he creates his son Mordred in a sort of illicit relationship, really. So he, out of his shadow side, creates this figure, this destructive figure of Mordred, who raises the kingdom against Arthur. And so in the Mort d'Arthur, you get this extraordinary encounter of the father and the son, where which Arthur kills Mordred but is fatally wounded by Mordred in that same thing. And just like the maimed king, he is maimed with a lance, and he, in a sense, doesn't die. He is taken off to Avalon by Berinthus and the nine queens, sometimes the three queens, and is taken into Avalon in order to come again. So, in a certain sense, Arthur, at his end, himself goes on to the next layer and becomes the Grail King. So these are two interlocking stories, really, the Grail stories and the Arthurian stories. And I suppose if we were aligning them on the Tree of Life, it would be the Arthurian story very much relates to that middle triangle of the tree, whereas the Grail story relates to the supernal triangle. The Arthurian story relates to the middle triangle of the Tree of Life, in a certain sense, we could say, the establishment of Tiferet and Geburah and Gedula, whereas the Grail story really takes us into the realm of the supernals. I'm going to read you a poem from the Victorian figure of Alfred Lord Tennyson. I haven't read for a long time, but was reading. It covers a lot of this territory. So just bear with me a moment. It'll become clear once I start explaining it. But just sit back for a moment and just listen to the poem. This is called The Coming of Arthur. Leodogran, the king of Cameliard, had one fair daughter and none other child. And she was fairest of all flesh on earth, Guinevere. And in her his one delight. For many a petty king ere Arthur came ruled in this island, and ever waging war each upon the other, wasted all the land. And still, from time to time, the heathen host swarmed overseas and harried what was left. And so there grew great tracts of wilderness, wherein the beast was ever more and more, but man was less and less, till Arthur came. For first Aurelius lived and fought and died, and after him King Uther fought and died, but either failed to make the kingdom one. And after these, King Arthur for a space, and through the puissance of his Table Round, drew all their petty princedoms under him, their king and head, and made a realm and reigned. And thus, coming back to right now, and thus the land of Cameliard was waste, thick with wet woods and many a beast therein, and none or few to scare or chase the beast, so that wild dog and wolf and boar and bear came night and day and rooted in the fields and wallowed in the gardens of the king. And ever and anon the wolf would steal the children and devour, but now and then her own brood, lost or dead, lent her fierce teat to human sucklings. And the children, housed in her den, there at their meat would growl and mock their foster mother on 4 feet, till, straightened, they grew up to wolf-like men, worse than wolves. And King Leogran, grown from the Roman legions, here again, and Caesar's eagle. Then his brother King Urien assailed him, last a heathen horde, reddening the sun with smoke and earth with blood, and on the spike that split the mother's heart, spitting the child, brake on him, till amazed he knew not whether he should turn for aid. But, for he heard of Arthur newly crowned, though not without an uproar made by those who cried, "He is not Arthur's son." The king sent to him, saying, "Arise and help us, thou, for here between the man and beast we die." And Arthur yet had done no deed of arms, but heard the call, and came, and Guinevere stood by the castle walls to watch him pass. but since he neither wore on helm or shield the golden symbol of his kinglihood, but rode a simple knight among his knights. And many of these in richer arms than he, she saw him not, or mark not if she saw, one among many, though his face was bare. But Arthur, looking downwards as he passed, felt the light of her eyes into his life. Smite on the sudden, yet rode on, and pitched his tents beside the forest. Then he drove the heathen, after slew the beast, and felled the forest, letting in the sun, and made broad pathways for the hunter and the knight, and so returned. For while he lingered there, a doubt that ever smouldered in the hearts of those great lords and barons of his realm flashed forth and into war. For most of these, colleaguing with a score of petty kings, made head against him, crying, "Who is he that he should rule us? Who hath proven him King Uther's son? For lo, we look at him, and find nor face, nor bearing, nor limbs, nor voice, are like those to Uther whom we knew. This is a son of Gorlice, not the king. This is a son of Anton, not the king." And Arthur, passing thence to battle, felt travail and throes and agonies of the life, desiring to be joined with Guinevere, and thinking as he rode, "Well, her father said that there between the man and beast they die. Shall I not lift her from this land of beasts up to my throne, and side by side with me? What happiness to reign a lonely king! Oh, I am vexed with stars that shadow over me, or earth that sounds hollow under me. I am vexed with waste dreams. For saving I be joined to her that is the fairest under heaven, I seem as nothing in the mighty world, and cannot will my will, nor work my work wholly, nor make myself in my own realm victor and lord. But were I joined with her, then might we live together as one life, and reigning with one will in everything, have power on this dark land to lighten it, and power on this dead world to make it live." Thereafter, as he speaks, who tells the tale, when Arthur reached a field of battle bright with pitched pavilions of his foe, the world was so clear about him that he saw the smallest rock far on the faintest hill, and even in high day the morning star. So when the king had set his banner broad, and once from either side with trumpet blast and shouts and clarions shrilling unto blood, the long lance battle let their horses run, and now the barons and the kings prevailed. And now the king, as here and there, that war went swaying. But the powers who walk the world made lightnings and great thunders over him, and dazed all eyes, till Arthur by main might and mightier of his hands with every blow, and leading all his knighthood through the kings, Carados, Urien, Cradlemont of Wales, Claudius, Clarience of Northumberland, and King Brandegoris of Latangor, with Anguist of Erin of Morganore, and Lot of Orkney. Then before a voice as dreadful as a shout of one who sees, to one who sins and deems himself alone, and all the world asleep, they swerved and brake flying, and Arthur called to stay the swords that hacked among the flyers. Ho, they yield. So like a painted battle the war stood, silenced, the living quiet as the dead. And in the heart of Arthur joy was lord. He laughed upon his warrior whom he loved and honoured most. "Thou dost not doubt me, king, so well thine arm hath wrought for me today. Sir, my liege," he cried, "the fire of God descends upon thee in the battlefield. I know thee for my king." Whereat the two, for each had warded either in the fight, swear on the field of death a deathless love. And Arthur said, "Man's word is God in man. Let chance what will, I trust thee to the death." And quickly from the foughten field he sought Ulfius, Brastius, and Bedivere, his newman made knights, to King Leogrand, saying, "If I in aught have served thee well, give me thy daughter Guinevere to wife." Whom when he heard, Leogrand in heart debating, "How should I that am a king, however much he helps me, give my one daughter, save only to a king and a king's son?" He lifted his voice and called a hoary man, his chamberlain, to whom he trusted all things, and of him required his counsel. "Knowest thou aught of Arthur's birth?" Then spake the hoary chamberlain and said, "Sir King, there be but two old men that know, and each is twice as old as I, and one is Merlin, the wise man that ever served King Uther through his magic art, and one is Merlin's master, so they call him, Blaise, who taught him magic. But the scholar ran before the master, and so far that Blaise lay magic by, and sat him down, and wrote all things and whatsoever Merlin did, in one great annal book, where after years will learn the secret of our Arthur's birth. To whom the King Leogrand replied, "Oh, my friend, had I been helped half as well by this King Arthur as by thee today, then beast and man that had their share of me, but summon here before us yet once more, Ulfius, Brastius, Bedivere." Then when they came before him, the king said, "I have seen the cuckoo chased by lesser fowl, and reason in the chase. But wherefore now do these your lords stir up the heat of war, some calling Arthur born of Govlice, others of Anton? Tell me ye yourselves, hold ye this Arthur for King Arthur's son?" And Ulfius and Brastius answered, "Aye." Then Bedivere, the first of all his knights, knighted by Arthur at his crowning, spake. For bold in heart and word was he, whenever slander breathed against the king. "Sir, there be many rumours on this head, for there be those who hate him in their hearts, call him baseborn, and since his ways are sweet and theirs are bestial, hold him less than man. And there be those who deem him more than man, and dream he dropped from heaven. But my belief in all this matter, if you care to learn, sir, for you know that in King Arthur's time, the prince and warrior Gorlice, he that held Tintagel Castle by the Cornish Sea, was wedded with a winsome wife, Igraine, and daughters had she borne him, one whereof Lot's wife, the Queen of Orkney, Bellicent, hath ever like a loyal sister cleaved to Arthur, but a son she had not borne. And Arthur cast upon her eyes of love, but she, a stainless wife to Gorlice, so loathed the bright dishonour of his love, that Gorlice and King Arthur went to war, and overthrown was Gorlice and slain, and Arthur in his wrath and heat besieged Igraine within Tintagel, where her men, seeing the mighty swarm about their walls, left her and fled, and Arthur entered in. And there was none to call to but himself, so encompassed by the power of the king, enforced she was to wed him in her tears, and with a shameful swiftness. Afterward, not many moons, King Arthur died himself, moaning and wailing for an heir to rule after him, lest the realm should go to rack. And that same night, the night of the new year, by reason of the bitterness and grief that vexed his mother, all before his time, was Arthur born, and all as soon as born, delivered at a secret postern gate to Merlin, to be holden far apart until his hour should come, because the lords of that fierce day were as the lords of this, wild beasts, and surely would have torn the child piecemeal among them, had they known. For each but sought to rule for his own self and hand, and many hated Uther for the sake of Gorlice. Whereby Merlin took the child and gave him to Sir Anton, an old knight, an ancient friend of Uther and his wife. His wife nursed the young prince and reared him with her own, and no man knew. And ever since the lords have foughten like wild beasts among themselves, so that the realm has gone to rack. But now, this year, when Merlin, for his hour had come, brought Arthur forth and set him in the hall, proclaiming, "Here is Arthur's heir, your king," 100 voices cried, "Away with him, no king of ours, a son of Gorlice, or else the child of Anton, and no king, or else baseborn." Yet Merlin threw his craft, and while the people clamoured for a king, had Arthur crowned, but after the great lords banded, and so break out in open war. Then while the king debated with himself if Arthur were the child of shamefulness, or born the son of Gorlice after death, or Uther's son and born before his time, or whether there was truth in anything said by these three, they came to Cameliard with Gawain and young Modred, her two sons, Lot's wife, the Queen of Orkney, Bellicent, whom as he could, not as he would, the king made feast for, saying as they sat at meat, "A doubtful throne is ice on summer seas. You come from Arthur's court, victor his men report him. Yea, but ye think ye this king, so many that of those that hate him and so strong, so few his knights, however brave they be, has he body enough to hold his foemen down? O king," she cried, "and I will tell thee, few, but all brave, all of one mind with him. For I was near him when the savage yells of Uther's peerage died, and Arthur sat crowned on the dais, and his warriors cried, 'Be thou the king, and we will work thy will who love thee.' Then the king, in low, deep tones and simple words of great authority, bound them by so straight vows to his own self, that when they rose knighted from kneeling, some were pale as at the passing of a ghost, some flushed and others dazed, as one who wakes half-blinded at the coming of a light. But when he spake and cheered his table round with large, divine, and comfortable words, beyond my tongue to tell thee, I beheld from eye to eye through all their order flash a momentary likeness of the king. And ere it left their faces, through the cross and those around it and the crucified, down from the window over Arthur smote flame colour, green and blue, in three great rays, one falling upon each of three fair queens who stood in silence near his throne, the friends of Arthur gazing on him tall with bright sweet faces who will help him at his need. And there I saw Mage Merlin, whose vast wit and 100 winters are but as the hands of loyal vessels toiling for their liege. And near him stood the Lady of the Lake, who knows a subtler magic than his own, clothed in white samite, mystic, wonderful. She gave the king his huge cross-hilted sword, whereby to drive the heathen out. A mist of incense curled about her, and her face well nigh was hidden in the minster gloom. But there was heard among the holy hymns a voice as of the waters, for she dwells down in a deep, calm, whatsoever storms may shake the world, and when the surface rolls has power to walk the waters like our Lord. There likewise I beheld Excalibur, before him at his crowning borne. The sword had rose out of the bosom of the lake, and Arthur rode across and took it, rich with jewels, elfin Urib on the hilt. Bewildering heart and eye, the blade so bright that men are blinded by it. On one side graven in the oldest tongue of all this world, "Take me." But turn the blade, and ye shall see, and written in the speech ye speak yourself, "Cast me away." And sad was Arthur's face taking it, but old Merlin counselled him, "Take thou and strike, the time to cast away is yet far off." So this great sword the king took, and by this will beat his foemen down. Thereat Leodgrand rejoiced, but thought to sift his doubtings to the last, and asked, fixing full eyes of question on her face, "The swallow and the swift are near akin, but thou art closer to this noble prince, being his own dear sister." And she said, "Daughter of Govlice and Igraine am I, and therefore Arthur's sister?" asked the king. She answered, "These be secret things," and signed to these two sons to pass and let them be. And Gawain went out, and breaking into song, sprang out, and followed by his flying hair, ran like a colt, and leapt at all he saw. But Mordred laid his heir beside the doors, and there half heard the same that afterward struck for the throne, and striking found his doom. And then the queen made answer, "What know I? For dark my mother was in eyes and hair, and dark in hair and eyes am I, and dark was Govlice, yea, and dark was Uther true, well nigh to blackness. But this king is fair beyond the race of Britons and of men. Moreover, always in my mind I hear a cry from out the dawning of my life, a mother weeping, and I hear her say, 'Oh, that he had some brother, pretty one, to guard thee on the rough ways of the world.'" "Aye," said the king, "and hear ye such a cry, but when did Arthur chance upon thee first?" "O king," she cried, "and I will tell you true, he found me first when yet a little maid. Beaten I had been for a little fault, whereof I was not guilty, and out I ran, and flung myself down on a bank of heath, and hated this fair world and all therein, and wept and wished that I were dead. And he, I know not whether of himself he came or brought by Merlin, who they say can walk unseen at pleasure, he was at my side, and spoke sweet words, and comforted my heart, and dried my tears, being a child with me. And many a time he came, and evermore, as I grew greater, grew with me. And sad at times he seemed, and sad with him was I, sterner too at times, and then I loved him not, but sweet again, and then I loved him well. But now of late I see him less and less, but those first days had golden hours for me, for then I surely thought he would be king. But let me tell thee now another tale, for Blaise, our Merlin's master, as they say, died but of late, and sent his cry to me. To hear him speak before he left his life, shrunk like a fairy changeling lay the mage. And when I entered, told me that himself and Merlin ever served about the king. Uther, before he died, and on the night when Uther in Tintagel passed away, moaning and wailing for an heir, the two left the still king, and passing forth to breathe. Then from the castle gateway by the chasm, descending through the dismal night, a night in which the bounds of heaven and earth were lost. Behold, so high upon the dreary deeps it seemed in heaven, a ship, the shape thereof a dragon winged, and all from stem to stern, bright with a shining people on the decks, and gone as soon as seen. And then the two dropped to the cove and watched the great sea fall, wave after wave, and each mightier than the last, till last a ninth one, gathering half the deep and full of voices, slowly rose and plunged roaring, and all the wave was in the flame, and down the wave and in the flame was born a naked babe, and rode to Merlin's feet, who stooped and caught the babe and cried, "The king, here is an heir for Uther." And the fringe of that great breaker, sweeping up the strand, lashed at the wizard as he spoke the word, and all at once all round him rose in fire, so the child and he were clothed in fire. And presently there followed calm, calm free sky and stars, and this same child, he said, is he who reigns, nor could I part in peace till this were told. And saying this, the seer went through the strait and dreadful pass of death, not ever to be questioned any more, save on the further side. But when I met Merlin and asked him if these things were true, the shining dragon and the naked child, descending in the glory of the seas, he laughed, as was his wont, and answered me in riddling triplets of old time, and said, "Rain, rain and sun, a rainbow in the sky, a young man will be wiser by and by, an old man's wit may wander ere he die. Rain, rain and sun, a rainbow on the lea, and truth is this to me and that to thee, and truth or clothed or naked let it be, rain, sun and rain, and the free blossom blows, sun, rain and sun, and where is he who knows, from the great deep to the great deep he goes." So Merlin riddling angered me, "But thou fear not to give this king thine only child Guinevere, so great bards of him will sing hereafter, and dark sayings from of old, ranging and ringing through the minds of men, and echoed by old folk beside their fires, for comfort after their wage work is done, speak of the king, and Merlin in our time has spoken also, not in jest, and sworn, though men may wound him, that he will not die, but pass again to come, and then or now utterly smite the heathen underfoot, the Lees and all men hail him for their king." She spake, and King Leogrand rejoiced, but musing, "Shall I answer yea or nay?" Doubted and drowsed, nodded and slept, and saw, dreaming, a slope of land that ever grew, field after field up to a height, the peak haze hidden, and thereon a phantom king, now looming and now lost, and on the slope the sword rose, the hind fell, the herd was driven, fire glimpsed, and all the land from roof and rick in drifts of smoke before a rolling wind streamed to the peak and mingled with the haze and made it thicker, while the phantom king sent out at times a voice, and here or there stood one who pointed to the voice, the rest slew on and burned, crying, "No king of ours, no son of Uther, no king of ours," till with a wink his dream was changed. The haze descended, and solid earth became as nothing, but the king stood out in heaven crowned, and Leogran awoke and sent Alpheus and Brastius and Bedivere back to the court of Arthur, answering yea. And Arthur charged his warrior, whom he loved and honoured most, Sir Lancelot, to ride forth and bring the queen, and watched him from the gates. And Lancelot passed among the flowers, and returned among the flowers in May with Guinevere, to whom arrived by Dubric, the high saint, chief of the church in Britain, and before the stateliest of our altar shrines, the king that morn was married, while in stainless white, the fair beginners of a nobler time. and glorying in their vows and him, his knights stood round him, rejoicing in his joy. Far shone the fields of May through open door. The sacred altar blossomed white with May. The sun of May descended on their king. They gazed on all earth's beauty in their queen. Rolled incense, and there passed along the hymns a voice as of the waters, while the two swear at the shrine of Christ a deathless love. And Arthur said, "Behold, thy doom is mine. Let chance what will, I love thee to the death." To whom the queen replied with drooping eyes, "King and my lord, I love thee to the death." And holy Dubric spread his hands and spake, "Reign ye, and live, and love, and make the world other, and may thy queen be one with thee, and all the order of this table round fulfil the boundless purpose of their king." So Dubric said, but when they left the shrine, great lords from Rome before the portal stood, in scornful stillness gazing as they passed. Then while they passed, paced a city all in fire, with sun and cloth of gold the trumpets blew, and Arthur's knighthood sang before the king. "Blow, trumpet, for the world is white with May. Blow, trumpet, the long night hath rolled away. Blow through the living world, let the king reign. Shall Rum or heathen rule in Arthur's realm? Flash sword and lance, fall battle axe on helm. Fall battle axe and flash sword, let the king reign. Strike for the king and live," his knights have heard, "that God hath told the king a secret word. Fall battle axe and flash sword, let the king reign. Blow, trumpet, he will lift us from the dust. Blow, trumpet, live the strength and die the lust. Clang battle axe and clash sword, let the king reign. Strike for the king and die, and if thou diest, the king is king and ever will the highest. Clang battle axe and clash sword, let the king reign. Blow, for our son is mighty in his May. Blow, for our son is mightier day by day. Clang battle axe and clash sword, let the king reign. The king will follow Christ, and we the king, in whom high God hath breathed the secret thing. Fall battle axe and flash sword, let the king reign." So sang the knighthood, moving to their hall. There at the banquet, those great lords from Rome, the slowly fading mistress of the world, strode in and claimed their tribute as of old. But Arthur spake, "Behold, for these have sworn to wage my wars and worship me their king. The old order changeth, yielding place to new. And we that fight for our fair father Christ, seeing that ye be grown too weak and old to drive the heathen from your Roman wall, no tribute will we pay." So those great lords drew back in wrath, and Arthur strove with Rome. And Arthur and his knighthood for a space were all one will, and through that strength the king drew all the petty princes under him, fought, and in 12 battles, great battles, overcame the heathen hordes and made a realm and reigned. So just close your eyes for a moment. And just let your attention just sink inwards and downwards. And find yourselves again upon the white path, in the midst of the forest. Walking into the wood. But noticing on this occasion, walking before us, is a man wearing the mask of a jackal. And as you walk beside him, behind him, near him, it is as if your movements synchronize with his. And almost as if he steps back or you forward, and you find yourself walking as him, feeling the jackal mask upon your head, feeling the sureness of foot as you walk forward, opening the way. And on this occasion, as you come to the jetty, it is as if there is a path of light across the waters. And you walk across, held by the great deeps, from the great deep to the great deep we go. Feeling the waters holding us as if glass, as if ice. As we walk across the lake, as we look through the mask of Anubis, as we are carried in that consciousness. And we find ourselves again before the stronghold. And we find ourselves again upon the sword bridge, but stepping lightly, easily, without hesitation, without fear. Feeling the sense of perfect balance. For the way continually opens before us. We pass through the straight and narrow gate. And enter the castle. And as we enter the castle, we look with the eyes of the mask of Anubis. And it is as if for a moment we see the whole of the castle, the hall of the round table in which we stand, and all the chambers of the castle, and the many paths. It is as if the whole of the castle is open to us. We contemplate the grail and the spear, the king and the queen, the round table, the spiral stair, that leads down into Malchut, into the hall carved out of the living rock. And here we find the sword that is a cross embedded in that rock. And as we stand before it, we find again the perfect balance of left and right, of before and behind. And we know that we are one who speaks with a just voice. For we are carried in that presence of balance, of kindness, who opens always the way. And as the opener of the ways, We stand before the 31st path. We stand at the lintels of the door. And stepping through it, carried by that consciousness, we enter the path of fire. We enter the path of resurrection, where the child is found and bathed in fire that does not burn but sanctifies. We feel again that place of balance, the place of meeting of Raphael and Sandalphon. We find again the place of perfect centeredness. We find the sovereignty of the living kingdom in our hearts. We find the perfect balance of the opener of the ways in our frame. We stand in the middle of the way. We stand amongst the fire and the breath. We feel the wind of fire that blows through us, that makes all things new. The Ruach Elohim that renews each cell, each thought, each moment of being, dies and is reborn. And we, as bearer of the jackal mask, as servant of the mystery, assists the weighing of the heart, assists the resurrection of the body. So that which has died may live again. So the King will come again. In perfect truth and perfect balance. From the great deep to the great deep we go.